This week, we welcome Michael Malley, Senior Vice President of Strategy at Seneca Global, to discuss new AI algorithm regulations are coming. Will yours pass government scrutiny? In the leadership and communication section, cybersecurity starts with the board and C-suite, or at least it should. How CISOs can achieve more with less during uncertain economic times, why authentic leadership is so hard, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is a Security Weekly production for security professionals by security professionals. Please visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to all the shows on our network. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly.
According to the 2022 Data Breach Investigations Report, the human remains the number one driver of breaches today, demonstrating that cybersecurity is no longer just a technical challenge, but a human one as well. But how do you manage the human risks of cybersecurity? It starts with measurement. Only by effectively quantifying human risk can organizations engage employees with relevant activities to truly change human behavior. That's human risk management. Map key human behaviors to the business risks that matter most to your organization for free by visiting securityweekly.com/livingsecurity. Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 308, recorded June 5th, 2023. I am your host, Matt Alderman. It's official. I am no longer a parent of a teenager. Baby boy is 20. Happy birthday, Brendan. Joining remotely for this segment, for today's segments, are my co-hosts, Mr. Jason Albuquerque in studio.
In studio. Yeah, I'm liking coming into studio, man. So this is good. Especially now that, you know, all New England sports has kind of gone down the toilet for me. The Red Sox are losing hardcore, so I'm not even paying attention there. My Celtics lost in the semifinals. And football is, you know, I mean, we got to wait, you know.
Got to wait
for football season. So. And my Bruins, season. Too. My Bruins didn't make it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was a crazy overtime loss that changed that whole series. Anyways, yeah, we won't go there because I have a lot of friends in Boston that feel the same way you do, Jason. Also joining today, Mr. Ben Carr. How you doing, Ben?
I am doing well. It's been really nice down here in the Austin area. We get some a little bit of rain, more rain than we've had in a while. But yeah, it's been great. So just getting ready for summer to kick off. Kids are out of school. Things are going well, moving forward on the house. So, yeah, great times.
Yeah, I mean, we were commenting last night. We got the rain come through last night. I was like, it wasn't like this in June last year. We were already in the hundreds. No. Like this, it's been a beautiful spring and early part of the summer. So,
yeah, just great weather.
Great weather. Our teams from Security Weekly and SC Media were on site at RSA Conference 2023, delivering in-depth reporting, analysis, and interviews from the conference. If you were unable to join us in person or didn't manage to catch our video live stream from Broadcast Alley, you can access all of our RSA 2023 content at securityweekly.com/RSAC. Michael Malley is the SVP of Strategy at Seneca Global, a leading provider of innovation outsourcing to solve complex technology challenges. He's been in product development for 20 plus years, leading development, product management, marketing, and M&A in the tech space. Throughout his career, Mike has combined deep engineering knowledge with business acumen to help companies figure out what creates success in the market for a product or solution. Then he builds and coaches teams to make it happen again and again. Mike, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thank you, Matt, for having me. I do appreciate it. And I'm based in Chicago, so we are perpetually in sports morning. So,
Mike, just so you know, I'm originally from Cleveland. So I've been in sports morning since about the time I was born.
Okay, it's not that bad, but Chicago's getting close. So we need something soon.
There is always hope, okay? The Patriots of the 80s when I was a kid sucked. So there's always hope. And look what happened. The dynasty happened.
That is true. We are hoping. We are actually rooting for Jimmy Butler. If our teams can't win, at least maybe some of our former players can.
So there you go. Yeah. All right. So, Mike, we're going to get into the American Data Privacy and Protection Act. What I think is interesting about this legislation, it's been around for a little while, right? We've talked about privacy regulations at the federal level on this show multiple times, right? I don't think it's efficient to have multiple state regulations out there. I've always wanted the feds to do something. They've been dragging their feet for decades. So here we have this legislation, been around for a little bit, but it's starting to pick up a little steam. And I think some of that steam has to do with some of the new things around artificial intelligence and ChatGPT. Let's talk about, like, what does this legislation look like and why is it starting to get some momentum?
Sure. So from a standpoint of why is it gaining momentum right now, I think there's an evolution in thinking, right? If you look at back when GDPR and some of those and the California regulation and some of those things happened, it was really around data privacy. And specifically, they were worried about the problem of, are you keeping my personal records safe, right? And now through the years, people have realized that there are additional questions, and especially now with more and more powerful AI algorithms, now the conversation has evolved to the next level. And now it's around, okay, now that you have this data and you're protecting it, now what are you doing with it? And so now it's getting into a discussion around the algorithm itself. Is the algorithm safe? Is the algorithm effective? Is the algorithm non-biased? And how am I using this album? How am I training it? And then how am I using it in the marketplace?
Yeah, so it's kind of the what aspects of, like, what are you doing with the data now that you've collected it? Then, you know, what does that mean for data, things like data provenance, right? I mean, we've talked a little bit about data provenance, probably not enough in some of the impacts of what happens when the data gets manipulated and what does it do on the other side, which I don't know that this legislation will address or not, but there are a lot of open questions about, now that I have the data, what are you doing with it? And how is this going to impact products and services and other outcomes that people haven't thought about before?
Correct. I think the most important thing for your audience to understand from a CISO or a C-level executive standpoint, right, is that you're going to need to understand within your business what AI algorithms are being used, and you're going to need to prepare some type of justification. Meaning, if you look at the legislation today, it says that these algorithms are going to be audited and that you're going to have to prepare a report from an outside third party and give that to the Federal Trade Commission, who's going to look at that report and then basically verify that what you're doing is okay. And so I think the first and most important thing for CISOs to understand is today, if I look at that environment today, right, I'm just scrambling, I'm using best-in-class products, I'm trying to, you know, fight fire with fire, in that there are bad guys using bots, leveraging AI, doing things like that to try to hack into my network and steal sensitive data, right? But now going forward, I need to defend myself. I'm largely going to do that with AI algorithms because those algorithms are more efficient than humans. They don't make human errors, right? There's lots of great reasons why security wants to leverage AI, which we all know about. But now you're going to need to justify, what is that AI doing, the data that it's working with, right? And exactly how and what am I leveraging within my business that I didn't need to do before? That's the big so what.
So now, Mike, in our pre-show banter, you had talked about this has already gone through subcommittee. It's on the docket to hit the House floor. So a version of this, there is a potential of a version of this passing. In the oversight, you know, arm enforced by Federal Trade Commission, who's considered a covered entity? Who would fall under this bill from a business perspective? Are there certain size businesses? Are there classifications? Who would be a covered entity?
That's a great question. So the answer is there are certain size businesses, but it's interesting in that the business size is not only determined by revenue, but it's also determined by number of records. So for example, at Seneca Global, we work with a lot of security startups. So a lot of security startups are concerned about this and are putting processes in place for this today, because even though they may not have the revenue base, they are going to have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of records. And so it's not only about amount of revenue, but it's also about amount of records that you're holding. And those are the two thresholds that in some form are going to be used to determine whether you're going to fall under this law or not.
Okay. Now, to that point, are there exemptions? Is there any exemption rule in there as far as businesses are concerned? Or at the end of the day, you know, I always have the concern of, would federal, state, and local government fall under this? Does this cover? I mean, it's FTC. That's the enforcement arm. So yeah. That lends me to believe that government will not be enforced by this bill.
Yeah, the way the legislation is written today, it's written talking about businesses mm-hmm. and the AI and algorithm and software that they're using to protect their business and that they're offering to consumers. So there really isn't any wording in there today talking about municipal government or things like that. It's really focused on businesses themselves. Mm-hmm. But as we said, this is going to the House floor. So I think the thing to notice is the fact that it's going to change in some form. All bills do, right? It hasn't even made it to the Senate yet. But the important thing to note is there's growing momentum about this. There are lots of hearings going on. There's lots of discussion happening in Silicon Valley and other high-tech communities because there's a belief that in some form or another, this is going to pass and that companies are going to be required to provide some type of justification for the algorithms and the AI that they're using.
Yeah, interesting. Now, I'd like to talk through, because Jason, you use pieces today. I'm curious, mm-hmm. like, what do you see as the potential impact to what you're already doing with AI in your existing environment? Like, do you see a potential impact here?
I mean, I, again, the devil's in the details with the bill, right? Because I'm using a third-party AI. So just, you know, transparency, Mike, IT services organization, right? So IT consulting, IT managed yep. services, we play heavy in the Microsoft space. So a lot of the tools we use are driven by Microsoft's AI, right? The chat bots and things of that nature. And you know, the question becomes, does there become some liability on our side for using these tools to, you know, because we're not processing data, we're not transferring data, but we would have clients.
Yeah, where's the boundary within, layer, yeah, right, Jason?
Where is that?
Where do you draw that line? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what we're going to see is, I think you're going to see a breakdown between software organizations and service organizations, mm-hmm. right? And what I think you're going to see is that this is going to certainly apply to all software organizations. They're going to have to comply with this. And then out of this, there's going to be some type of stamp of approval coming from the FTC or someone to say that this algorithm is safe, this algorithm is non-biased, et cetera. And then that's going to be some type of certification that you're going to have to show in order to commercially sell that. Right. And then as part of this, if you're a services organization, you're going to need to check and confirm that all of the tools that you're using have passed this, have those certifications, and those certifications are current because on an annual basis, right, those certifications are going to need to be updated. So I think it's going to move into that type of a scenario yeah. where you've got services organizations that are going to require the certifications to pass on to their customers, but also software organizations that are going to need to get the certifications in the first place and get approval.
Yeah. So for the software companies and the manufacturers, it's going to be, they're the ones that are going to have to go through the audit. For us, for a services organization, it's part of our third-party vendor risk management program. We're going to have to embed this there to make sure that they have those certifications. So that way our customers feel comfortable doing business with us. Is that
exactly? Exactly. And I think then the other fly in the ointment that they'll have to think about through the legislation, or we'll have to see how this gets implemented, mm-hmm. is if I am a business that buys a piece of software, for example, that is just an AI algorithm itself, if I'm starting to use those building blocks to build and customize my own applications inside my business, now I've got to go through this process as well.
Got it.
Right. And so you can think of a scenario where let's take permissions, right, as an example. I'm looking at cloud permissions and I want to make sure that I'm not giving too many permissions to too many people inside my organization. I want to see how they are used to make sure there aren't bad actors trying to get in. Well, if I am taking algorithms and buying those, and now I'm looking at databases that I own with inside my company, of usage data and how my employees and my customers and things like that are using the product and how they normally behave. And my AI algorithm is munging on that data, trying to determine, are there good actors or bad actors, for example, trying to access my cloud? Well, now you could see a scenario where that company itself, even though they're not a software maker, so to speak, because they are customizing that for their own business, that there's going to be some amount of compliance they would have to have as well.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, I could see the scenario where that's going to end up in an outsourced solution where you're going to essentially try to outsource that risk and outsource that compliance activity where you're sending the data out, somebody's going to process it and send it back to try to obfuscate that. I mean, the issue right now is just from a privacy side, trying to comply with all the different regulations is making it onerously difficult for CISOs and privacy people to try to handle this internally. It's just, it's a mishmash of different regulations, right?
Yeah, correct. I think you make a great point, right? If I'm a CISO today and I'm looking at this legislation, part of what this is telling me is that I'm going to have to start relying on more additional third-party outside service organizations to help me with this and manage compliance, especially if I'm doing this level of customization. Otherwise, this is another task that's going to fall on me internally, right? And we all know that the role of a CISO today is a very tough role. People are generally not lasting very long in these types of roles. There's a lot of burnout in these roles. It's a really hard job. And there's no question that this is going to make it tougher and more complicated. And so you would think looking for third-party providers that have this expertise that can manage this for you is definitely going to be in demand.
How do you see the auditing process playing out? You know, one of the most recent regulations that I see and kind of saw play out is CMMC. Do you see it kind of following that same model where you have an accreditation body and then you have certified auditors and then those auditors will come in and audit your organization? Or do you see it more of a self-assessment, self-attestation type audit that these organizations are going to have to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is where, right, the legislation doesn't get particularly granular because obviously at the end of the day, primarily these are lawyers and advisors to lawyers in Congress writing the legislation. They're not technical people, right? And so there's a lot of question here about what is going to be that chain of command, right? They've specified that it needs to be an outside third party that conducts the audit because they don't want self-certification. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a software development organization or I'm a security product company, I can't audit it myself internally. I have to have some outside third party stamp it and say that it's safe and say that it's non-discriminatory and look at the training data and say it's okay. So there's definitely going to have to be some level, you would think, of accredited outside organizations of auditors who are looking at these algorithms and saying that those are okay. But this is where the devil gets into the details, right? After this likely passes in the implementation phase, and this type of ecosystem, I would think, is going to get set up.
Yeah, I mean, we saw this play out in Gramm-Leach-Bliley, Sarbanes-Oxley, other HIPAA, right? Where the requirements are set in the legislation, and then it takes us a while to figure out, like, what does that actually mean, and how do you implement it? I mean, I could see NIST getting tasked with creating a set of criteria to evaluate these kind of AI algorithms against, similar to what they've done with the cybersecurity framework, the 853 and other requirements, because I would not want to leave it up to the FTC and the willy-nilly nature of a government body to figure this out. You would want some solid criteria behind what the evaluation and audit would look like. And so this, potentially something for NIST to take on like they have in other regulations.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great comment, right? I think you're definitely going to want some type of consistency of the audits across multiple different companies. So you're talking then about auditing standards. So NIST or somebody would have to set that up, right? And then I think you're also talking about, some outside group that gets certified as having enough knowledge in AI algorithms and how they run, right, to determine, because part of the question here is going to be how much data is being used. Am I right? By the nature of AI algorithms, right, the more I can always give the algorithm more data and hopefully it becomes slightly more accurate, right? But the question is going to turn into what's enough, and what's accurate enough for the amount of privacy or the amount of liability that I'm giving up, right? And so I think there's definitely going to need to be some type of ecosystem set up of groups of, you know, technical auditors, right, that have that expertise to look at that to say, yes, you are using best in class procedures to build your algorithms and train your algorithms, and that the ends justifies the means.
So, Mike, you hit a point there, which I want to dive into and understand a little better and get your thoughts on it. Is you mentioned that, you know, you could provide the algorithm with more data and get better output. And I think while that's generally true, isn't the concern somewhat, especially as we start to figure out how we regulate and how we look at whether the AI is producing the data we expect, isn't that only part of the question, right? I mean, we could give it more data to get a better output based upon the data set. But if the underlying algorithm in and of itself is skewed, essentially trying to present the user with data that they want or what it thinks they want versus accurately analyzing the data in a non-biased way, or the underlying algorithm has some issue, right, that it's utilizing the data and the underlying complexity of the algorithm gets to a point where it becomes really, really difficult to truly understand that, right? Like there's the two sides of the coin. Is the data set the right data set you're analyzing on? And then is the algorithm actually generating based upon that data set the answer you would expect it to versus what it eventually generates?
Yes, I think you look at that correctly, right? I think there's two questions here, as you said, and the one question is going to be around the algorithm itself. Are you using the right algorithm? As you guys know, right, there's many different AI algorithm models that you can use on a data set, right, depending on what it is you're trying to solve for, what insights you're trying to get. So there's a question that needs to be answered on, are you using the right algorithm for the type of analysis that you want to do? And as you said, then once the answer, assuming the answer to that question is yes, then there's going to be a second question. And the second question is going to be, what is the data you're feeding it? What's the training data you're feeding it? Is it safe? Is it non-biased, right? Is it a good data set to use? And what's enough?
That
right
was going to be
that trade-off of privacy and, you know, privacy and efficacy. Is it the right set of data? How much data is being used, and where's the balance there? So I think there's two sets of questions.
My next question to you, Mike, was what are the duties of the covered entity? Are there any limitations to what they can collect, process, transfer, right? In data types, whether they can sell data, whether they can transfer. Is that covered in this bill? What is enough data? Or can these organizations just collect whatever the hell they want and put it into their AI algorithm?
So the way the bill is written today is that the companies need to justify through these third-party auditors. This is why this ecosystem is going to need to be set up. That this audit is going to need to justify the data that's being used. So that's how compliance in their minds, I think, today is going to go, is they need to justify whatever they're being used to say that's okay and have a third party auditor come in and basically agree with that.
So what's
and
reasonably
so then you're going
to
have that certification for that auditor.
So what's reasonably necessary to run their business? Is that
exactly. And so that's why you're going to have this trade off, right? Mm-hmm. Between what's the efficacy of the software application of the AI? Is it 90% effective, 85% effective, 95% effective? And with how much data does it use in order to give those recommendations? And where's the right trade-off there?
So now I want to flip it on its ear. What are my rights as a consumer? Does this bill cover consumer data rights like consent, objection, data ownership, control? Can I get my data revoked from these organizations?
So it does have some of that. Most of that obviously flows back to GDPR and CCPA and those, you know, those areas to basically use those as the rules in terms of protecting my data and giving me the right to revoke my data and see my data at any time. But there is some of that in here, but it's definitely not the focus of the bill.
Okay. So then we lean back on the state's rights, right? Because Matt covered that in the beginning. We have, you know, 40-something, 50, you know, privacy laws at the state level. the hope was that we could kind of, you know, flatten these out a little bit and get oversight at the federal level so we don't have to deal with 50 different privacy laws. I guess it doesn't do that then, right? We still have to rely on managing 50 privacy laws along with a federal law at this point, if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't going to replace CCPA or state laws, right? I think, you know, at least my belief mm-hmm. is that the hope is that the California law or some version of it will at some point become, you know, one of these states like California will become the de facto standard across the 50. Because like you said, you can't have 50 states doing different exactly. things, right? And right.
So my belief
is there'll be some convergence there. and then this will build on top of that.
Yeah, I hope so too, because it is really problematic right now. That's that is the way we're operating under, and it doesn't make any sense, you know. And then you expand it outside the U.S. like globally, it's even a bigger problem.
Right. So exactly, right. If you talk to any of these companies that are offering services, and I talk to many of these guys that are offering service across Europe, right? They are struggling with the fact that by and large, people are using GDPR as a default. Or using the California law as a default, but not everybody. And there are some tweaks to that, right? So there's definitely a question there with regard to, you know, data privacy separate from the algorithms, right? You want to converge on some type of overall standard there. And then this legislation hopefully builds on top of that.
Yeah. And the reason why I said 40 something and not 50 is because use Rhode Island as a case study. By no means do I think what we have right now written as a law is a comprehensive data privacy law. No way, shape, or form, right? So not all 50 states have anything that I would consider comprehensive, right? Because Rhode Island's law is weak. It really, truly is right now. So, you know, it creates that additional layer now that we have to manage as CISOs and risk officers and privacy officers.
Correct. I think that this brings you back to, right, that bigger point as a CISO, right, which is this is only getting more and more complex. Now I'm going to layer on top of this state by state question of how am I handling the data? I'm going to have to layer in now this additional question of how am I handling the algorithms, and are all these algorithms audited and are they safe, et cetera, right? It's just making the CISO's job much, much more difficult. And so this is where I think the CISOs are going to rely even more than they already do on outside service organizations in order to give them the peace of mind that they're going to require.
So is that the recommendation for the CISOs? Like, identify what you have and then quickly go find a third party to manage it for you to get ready? Because I add this to the existing CISO plate, it gets a little
tough. How do we prep? How do we prepare?
Part of the recommendation. I think it's getting an understanding of what you have today. I think it's understanding what is or is not being used there, right? How is that, you know, being used? And then how do I find and how do I start to establish this third-party ecosystem that's gonna protect me and provide these audits, et cetera, because otherwise it's all gonna fall on me. So I think it's a combination of, first of all, identifying what it is I'm using, right? Make sure I understand every piece of AI that's being operated within my company, right? Who owns it? Where's the software from? Am I doing it in-house? Do I have any homegrown stuff that I'm using? What are all those pieces, right?
Is it a hybrid though, right?
How it's being used and then looking for partners or looking for ways I can audit that.
Yeah, and Mike, that hybrid piece is huge too, because you could be taking, like we said earlier, an existing manufacturer's product, modifying it, creating your own intellectual property internally, and now all of a sudden becomes yours. You own it.
Yeah, this is where this gets very complex, right? As you know, because not only do I have the AI algorithms themselves, but now I have all the data sets. And so if I'm using outside data sets, or now am I using internal data sets, and am I using them as is, or am I tweaking them? And then what is that output then? Who, you know, that is that an off-the-shelf output, or is that a customized output? Right. A lot of companies that I know of are doing some level of customization on their own data to get the insights that they want. And liability for that is going to fall on them for compliance.
Yeah, I hear this and I feel like this is another instance of a FedRAMP like ecosystem, right? Where we're going to have consulting organizations, third party providers, trying to figure out how to get somebody that's actually certified when there's a very small list of people who are. This is not going to be fun for the CISO community.
Not at all. Not at all. And that's why it's so important that they start to pay attention to this and understand what's going on here, because some form of this is coming. And the sooner you prepare, the sooner you're going to be ready for it. Because as you said, this is a complicated issue.
Yes, it's very complicated. Mike, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, guys. I enjoyed it.
We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
How do you win the race against risk and safely lock down your cloud data without hiring an army of administrators? Introducing Least Privilege Automation, only from Varonis. Varonis eliminates data exposures while your employees work and while they sleep, making intelligent decisions about who needs access to data and who doesn't. Our cloud-native solution analyzes permissions and sharing links, monitors access activity, and classifies sensitive data. Because Varonis knows who can and who does access critical data, our automation safely remediates risky links and permissions. Learn more at securityweekly.com/Varonis.
Created in 2005 and hosted by security industry veterans, Paul Security Weekly is your source for in-depth coverage of the latest vulnerabilities, exploits, and security research. Our weekly security news discussion dives deep into the security issues we face today and potential solutions in a fun and lively atmosphere. Each week, we bring on guests from the security community to learn about their journey and discuss topics relevant to their work and research. You can also subscribe to our show by visiting securityweekly.com/subscribe or look for Paul Security Weekly in your favorite podcast catcher. We've recorded a ton of content over the years, so we created Spotify playlists featuring some of our favorite episodes, including interviews with Marcus Random, John McAfee, and Chris Roberts, to name a few. You can find them at securityweekly.com/starterpacks.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Jason Albuquerque and Ben Carr. Join us at an upcoming official cybersecurity summit in a city near you. The series of one-day, invitation-only, executive-level conferences are designed to educate senior cyber professionals on the latest threat landscape. We are pleased to offer our listeners $100 off admission when you use code SECWEEK23 to register. Visit securityweekly.com/cybersecuritysummit to learn more and register today. All right, gentlemen, articles for this week. It's been a couple weeks, so I got, you know, I'll get a little picky again. It's nice when you have a couple weeks of content to choose from. So first article, cybersecurity starts with the board and C-suite, or at least it should, because that's not how this article starts.
I know. Hey, you want to know what? It's especially after the last segment, we're going to need everybody we can get to roll up their sleeves. We need all the help we can get if that bill passes.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, right.
And I read this article and I'm like, why is this news? Like, I know, why? I know. And then you read through it and you're like, I agree. But why is this not what everybody finds to be the actual reality in the world today as we know it? Right. Like I did a search. I wanted to see, like, is there any intelligence, any research on how many companies don't have a CISO? Right.
Right.
And it's been pretty consistent. I mean, I saw the same number in like 20 and 19. I saw the same in 22. And I there's a new report out in 23 that says 45% of companies don't employ a CISO.
Yeah.
That number is shocking. I mean, amazingly surprising.
Ben, in this article itself, it said 25% of boardrooms do not view cybersecurity as a priority. A quarter of the folks that were surveyed here don't view it as a priority, and they don't even discuss the topic regularly. And then they ranked the importance of cybersecurity to the board. Number one was the CISO's cybersecurity expertise. Number two was their technical expertise. And then runner-up third was risk management. Third was risk management. 38% said risk management is important. And we sit here on the show and say, you better learn how to manage risk. Otherwise, you're going to report to someone who does, right? So it's like, it's completely the opposite.
Yeah.
When I look at how this breaks down and you know, the fact that we're still talking about this issue, I haven't run into a company where I haven't seen cyber as either the top risk or at least in the top three. Like I haven't seen a company where that's different, right? If cyber is your number 10, I guess maybe you don't need a CISO, but like what company is that today, right? Like every company has a cyber footprint and is woefully unprepared for what's coming. I mean, most companies don't have the investment. They don't have the staff able to weather it. There's very few, you know, tier one companies from a cyber perspective out there that are fortified to be able to sustain it. But so
I still think leaders are still thinking of cybersecurity as a technical first problem.
Technical, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
that's right. That's what this is telling me. Is you still you're still thinking cybersecurity is a technologist only problem. It's not.
Yeah. Well, and they call that out in here, right? It's related to the CIO, and it's not at all related to the CIO.
Right. Well, the second article gets more into this whole concept of the CIO and CTO's role in cybersecurity. But to answer your first question, Ben, why is this out there? This is in directorsandboards.com, right? This article is meant to, I think, really train the board on the importance of cybersecurity, mm-hmm. not the other way around, because I think we all understand it on our side. I think this
why does the board not get that, right? Like, I'm sure we've all had experiences, right? Like talking to the board or at another board or hearing from other CISOs have talked to the board, and it's like, how do they not get it? And the amount of information that's out there currently, the amount of companies that are getting exposed in the upcoming, you know, the talk about SEC. So there's a lot of talk, but again, if the boards are identifying this as their number one, two, or three risk, then why are they not putting the time and investment into it? And that's, I'm still just gobsmacked by the fact that we don't see the importance raised up higher. And I think you're right. It's still a technical, it's still seen as a technical issue. And so somebody's got to be dealing with it, and we don't want to hear about the technical. But if you don't admit that it's a business level problem and there's a business level integration that has to be done with your security department, I don't think you'll ever get it.
Yeah, agreed. And so to talk about the technical aspects of cybersecurity, understanding the roles of the CISO, CIO, and CTO, and this one's to just double click on that point from the previous article. It's talking about how CTOs and CIOs hold the reins when it comes to cyber defense, and as a result should strive to build a culture of safety and security. Yes, but like it doesn't get into really kind of breaking up these roles to me, right? In the relationship of the CIO, the CTO, and the CISO in delivering cybersecurity. It spends a lot of time on CIO and CTOs, but it almost kind of ignores the CISO in some respect.
I know. I noticed that about this article too, you know, and I sat back and I said, all of the things that we need to be thinking about from policy, procedure, implementation of the technology, the governance side, all of these aspects of it, and all you're talking about is the CTO and the CIO, and every organization is different. No organization's the same. The responsibilities that a CIO have in organization A aren't necessarily the same responsibilities that the CIO in organization B have. You know, the thought process is this is a team effort. We have to be going after this as a team. We all have responsibilities. We all have accountability. We all need to be working tightly together. You know, the last organization I was in, the CTO was a client-facing role. 90% of what they did was customer-facing. It had nothing to do with internal. Did it influence internal? Absolutely. But it was 100% customer-facing.
So you know, if you read this article and you look through it, and I skimmed it, and I think I covered it and looked at the detail point that I wanted to get across here. But how many times is CISO actually mentioned in the article? It's in the title, and it's in the first word of this. CISO never comes up again. It's completely indicative of the problem. Like it's just an article about CTOs and CIOs. Mm-hmm. Like it's just get in the back room. I'm amazed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it talks about the
final words. Go ahead, Matt. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say it's talking about implementing security technology and and vendor risk management and all these other things. And there's no mention of the CISO in those roles. And the CIO's job, yes, is to deploy technology and create operational efficiencies from a technology perspective, not necessarily deploying security technology. Now, some do and some don't. It's going to vary by organization, right? Yeah. But they completely cut out the CISO in this article and to really understand the dynamics of those three roles. And that's where I think this article fell short because there are these dynamics and these relationships that have to be built between these three roles, they all play it from a very different perspective, but this article doesn't cover that.
And I think CIOs are...
That relationship between all of those roles is essential.
It really is. Yeah, it's got to be a partnership. You have to have a relationship. You have to build up that foundational communication and understanding of where the guidelines are, where are the delineation lines, right? How do you not cross the streams on that? But how do you work together really well? I mean, I think a lot of CIOs right now are going through this foundational transformation question of like, do they actually manage IT? Like, where does IT sit? Is it just if it's cloud services, is it just fit under the chief technology officer? And so I think that there's angst in that role in many organizations. But to talk about security and not have a CISO, or should it be a CSO, right? Risk officer, whatever it is, like foundationally, you need somebody who's purely focused on that and has the authority and the relationship within the C-suite to make sure that you're handling that appropriately.
Are we starting to see the evolution of the CISO role, though? Is it something that we have to start saying, you know what, maybe it's time we flip the chief risk officer, or maybe it's time we flip the chief privacy officer? I don't know. I'm just starting to see this trend of folks in businesses and boards not giving the respect to the CISO that they should be. And that's what's scaring me a little bit.
And I've been thinking on this a while, just I think like it, calling it a CISO, right? I think it almost should be a CSO or a risk officer or something, right? I mean, when you say CISO in information, it kind of belittles the point a little bit to the last discussion we had about privacy and the upcoming regulation and stuff, right? Like, whose responsibility is that? Is that the CTO? Is that the CISO? Is that like, where does it sit? And like, really, chief security officer, chief risk officer. Yeah. I mean, that's really as I see it. And I think it's a legacy term that comes from being related to the CIO and part of his staff, and if we truly want to elevate out of that, we have to think differently.
Right. And that's my point, because it's starting to feel like we're backpedaling. Instead of driving forward and maturing, it's starting to feel like we're backpedaling a little bit. And do we need to get to that next level of our evolution as executives who manage risk across the organization? Because every business is a technology business. Every business has data today, you know, and I'm starting to feel like we need to start moving forward and evolve.
Well, and I think Jason, Ben said it, but I don't think most CISOs have it, which is the authority. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the piece that's missing in that role that is actually kind of put that role on its heels. They don't have the authority at the executive level, and therefore maybe the role has to evolve into a chief privacy or chief risk officer who will have the authority to manage risk or privacy, and security becomes part of that risk or privacy conversation, because it doesn't appear that most CISOs have the authority to act on their own, and therefore it's a title without no authority, and
the problem, Matt, is that it has all the accountability. Well, that's the problem that I'm seeing. Has very little authority today, but when the stuff hits the fan, guess where it's falling? Right?
Yeah, and it's strange, because if you're in that C-level room, right, and you're having those conversations, and a marketing question comes up, right, or something has to happen from a marketing perspective within the organization, even outside of that room, there isn't a lot of debate upon who owns that ultimately, right? Mm-hmm. You may have a discussion about like, hey, have you thought about this, right? There's discussion in that room that happens to inform and make sure somebody's thinking about it, but at the end of the day, it's marketing, right? Or at the end of the day, it's sales. Mm-hmm. Or at the end of the day, it's operations. But when the security stuff comes up, like, everybody's got a perspective and a view, and everybody feels that they can say no. And that's really a strange place to be in. It's really, really weird.
And even vendor risk. When organizations are assessing you and they ask the question, who is the executive in charge of information security, data privacy? Guess what that answer is? The CISO. That's who gets filled out there. So all of that accountability and that burden and that weight is on the shoulders of the CISO.
It's on your shoulders.
But then they can't influence, right? So accountability, weight, limited ability to influence. And this is why we're it feels like we're backpedaling, and it's almost like we have to raise the game now and step up and, you know, just change how we're looking at this role and maybe become that chief privacy officer or chief risk officer or something like that. but with a seat at the table. It can't be, you know, it can't be CISO 2.0 where we just get a title change.
Look, it's, I think so many people are caught, it's not about the title at all, right? Isn't. I could care less what the title is. I just want the authority to be able to execute on behalf of the company and the responsibility that I need to do that.
You got it.
Right. Agreed. How to do more with less in the CISO role during economic times. I love this list because it starts with my favorite. Like, start with what you have.
Asset identification. Know what you have, right? Look at the last segment. The way we're going to get through this to prepare, guess what? Know what you have. Know how you're using it, you know, and data is part of that. But yeah, I mean, in order to be able to move the needle at all within the organization, you need to know what you have, right? That's how you get economies of scale. It's how you consolidate. It's how you reduce redundancies. It's how you get all of this done, right? You can't automate what you don't know you have. So all of these things in this list are pinned with know your environment, know what you have, know your assets across the board. Not just
and that's related to so many other areas of the org, right? Like finance. If you don't know what you have, if you don't know the systems and the assets and the costs, like how are you running your finance effectively, right? How are you running IT effectively if you don't know that? And so that one for me has always been a strange one that we haven't, that many companies haven't fixed, because if it does, it really affects so much of the organization, right? Yeah. It underpins everything we do in security. So that should be the core tenet. So I think doubling down on the things that are somewhat low-hanging fruit. I mean, I know it's not easy to get done, but it's an easy thing to identify, and everybody knows it's broken at most organizations.
Right. And assets are a huge swath of things, right? Because they talk about strategic partners. Well, guess what? I consider that an asset in my organization. My partnerships are an asset. I need to know who those partners are. Are they strategic or are they not? And if you don't have visibility into your partnerships, you know, how can you make strategic moves?
So, and if you don't have number one, you don't have asset identification, if you don't know what your systems and applications are, how do you do number two? How do you reduce redundancy?
That's right.
It foundationally underpins everything. Yep. Like the number of times you go in and go, I didn't know we had three applications that did the same thing. We can cut costs, right? We can reduce costs by 30% by getting rid of two of these applications, right? Yeah, your main application costs may go up, but your support, maintenance, your the quantity cost goes down by the number of people that are actually using it. So it is a cost reduction activity to do good asset management, make sure you know where things are and what they're doing. Yeah. And then that then ties into automation. Once you start focusing on those systems, you have the efficiency to be able to automate, right? And the scale. So, I mean, it's just so key to as you track down this list.
Yeah. I think one of the other things too that a lot of CISOs don't focus on is there was a bullet in here called innovation. And what I drove out of that is help the business drive revenue. Mm-hmm. How can you help the organization innovate to a point where you're influencing revenue? And you guys know that's always been on the forefront of my mind throughout my career is how do I take the security team's role out of operations and not just have our feet in operations, but how do we create a differentiator to help drive revenue?
Yeah. And you know, the one that I really look at right now is alignment with the CFO because budget constraints are real across the organization, right? Very real. If you're not working with the CFO and aligning spend, what's going to happen is you're going to be blindsided as a CISO. You're going to get an E5 contract pushed from the CIO and the CFO towards you, and you're going to have to figure out how to make it work because they're going to cut all your other budget. Exactly right.
That's the problem, is that it falls on your plate after it's been signed.
Correct.
Yeah, we joke about how to make it work. But like that's actually something like maybe given the org and your tolerance, maybe you can live with an E5, right? So maybe bringing that up as a, hey, we can switch and get out of some of this stuff and you can focus your spend on something that's actually moving the bubble. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not, depending upon your org, but unless you're making those choices and you have that, the ability when that discussion comes to be able to sit down, well, here's what I've already worked on. Here's the analysis that I've already done. You're never going to be able to play catch up on that because the ball is going to be moving too fast.
The one warning I would have is don't only align with the CFO. Have alignment with all the other business unit leaders, because the last thing one of your peers wants to see is that you're undermining their organization, right? A lot of what we talk about is, you know, the CISO relationship is built on trust. So you want to be able to be strategic across the organization. So have great relationships across the board. Talk about strategies, right, with all of the business unit leaders, and then be tight with the CFO. So at the time of presentation, or, you know, nobody's caught off guard. The last thing a peer wants is to be caught off guard when they're sitting in the room with the CEO and the CFO and the CISO, right?
So watch Game of Thrones several times and take lessons.
There's a level of political strategy. It's executive strategy. You have
alignment.
To have that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. This next one is a say easy, do hard. Mm-hmm. Why authentic leadership is so hard.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, I think we should dig into this one maybe in our next Say Easy, Do Hard segment.
I absolutely love this article because, you know, authenticity is great. But I sit back and I say, there's got to be a balance between your genuine authenticity and then the social norms that are out there that you have to navigate, right? There's a balance there. And we have to be cognizant of that. Right? We have to. You know, if COVID did anything, it started really breaking those things down where you can be a little bit more of your authentic self. There was a time in my career where a suit jacket was a daily thing for me. Had to be. 100% mm-hmm. had to be where I was. And it started breaking it down, right? And then you start seeing polos and, you know, things. But perception is real, right? I mean, you want to be able to have some level of respect when you walk in the door, and people are going to look at you in the first 30 seconds and make a judgment. That's just the nature of where we're at today. Is it unfortunate in many cases? Sure, but it's an unfortunate reality that we have to deal with. So it's a balance, right? Authenticity and then those social business norms that you have to navigate.
Yeah, and it's the intersection of authenticity with reality in some respects,
yeah.
Right? What is realistic in the marketplace? And I think as you listen to the different interviews that are in this segment, they talk about this.
Yeah.
Like, it would be great if, but in reality, that's not the case. And it's understanding that balance, right?
Right. And I mean, it comes in so many different forms, right? The way you dress, the way you communicate, the way you react in certain scenarios, right? I mean, it's just, there's so much to it where you have to have that genuine balance between the two.
Absolutely. Unlocking your leadership potential, the benefits of self-awareness for leaders. You know, we talk about this a lot, right? Really good leaders have great self-awareness, which drives emotional intelligence and the things that make great leaders great leaders. As I was reading this article and I was kind of reflecting, yes, the benefits are great, but there's also some interesting side effects of self-awareness. And as a leader, sometimes you realize you're in the wrong place.
Yes.
and it wasn't pulled out in this article. Like, it's showing all the benefits of improved communication, better decision-making, improved relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's like, wait a minute. It's also better alignment and whether you're right aligned to the organization. And I don't think people think about when you are very self-aware, there are also interesting side effects of that awareness.
Sure. 100%. And I mean, it ties back to that authenticity conversation that we're having too, right? You may not be a right fit for the organization. You just, it may not be a fit between the organization and yourself. So you have to weigh that. And you know, it has adverse effects because then it starts sending folks through confidence crisis, right? Is it me? Am I the problem? No, maybe it's just the fit, right? And that's where you start to see a lot of, you know, a lot of that mental fatigue when you start getting into the executive level, because it weighs on people and they start thinking it's themselves versus the alignment between the organization and themselves.
Well, the self-awareness then turns potentially into self-doubt.
Right, exactly it.
Right? Mm-hmm. Which is not necessarily the case, because then you start to doubt yourself because now you're so aware to what's going on around you and you're like, wait a minute, is this me? Is this the organization?
Yeah.
And it creates these very interesting scenarios for leaders on what do you do and how do you get through some of those crises?
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, as we think about our next Say Easy, Do Hard, I'm thinking something around leadership, because these are struggles for leaders. I've seen them throughout my career. I see them in my daily life, right? These are just areas that create these points in time that you have to try to navigate through as a leader. And they're either, sometimes they make you and sometimes they break you.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, being strong at self-awareness, empathy, emotional intelligence, having that as a strength, it's a blessing and a curse. It really, really is, because it makes you a great leader of people, but it also puts a heavy burden on you as a leader. It really does. There's a burden there, right? Because again, when you run into situations where you're leading a very highly effective team, you're doing a great job leading the team, but then your alignment upstream may not be great. That's when you start getting that self-doubt, and it's a heavy weight. The blessing and the curse.
Yep. Blessing and a curse, all in one. Love it.
It's a heavy head that wears the crown. I think that's the phrase.
Yeah. Last article. Four distractions that derail meetings and how to address those. I just lived this on Friday. Yeah. Like, so I went down to Austin on Friday. We're doing a roadmap planning and we're working on some stuff, right? And I'm reading this article going, oh my gosh, this was Friday. Like, you start with these base assumptions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're too big, sometimes they're too small. And you start going through refinement and you hit like every single one of these, right?
Yeah.
As you're going through the meeting. And you finish and we work through each of these, right? And luckily we did it in about an hour and a half. And so it didn't derail the entire meeting, but you can see pockets of all these things. Gravity, assumption, mm-hmm. The annoying kind of aspects. Like, it all played out on Friday.
Yeah.
And you get to the final piece and you're like, okay, we got to where we needed, which was alignment, which is great. It just, you had to go through each of these different components during that time period to get through it.
This is where the strength
like the stages of
being able to, yeah, right. You know, the ability to manage a meeting is very important, right? Be able to guide folks, because you're absolutely right. You know, there are times when meetings will get derailed and you're focusing on things that are completely out of your control. That's the gravity problem, right? This is not in our control. Let's put that aside. Let's parking lot it and let's start moving forward, right? And then we can figure out whether or not we can influence later. You know, assumption overload is huge. You get into meetings and it's the fear of the unknown and all of a sudden assumption. Well, we don't know that to be fact, right? Let's table that. Let's parking lot that and we can do a little bit more research later. The ability to take folks' input who are in the meeting, let them know that they've been heard, but then not allow it to derail a meeting. It's a science. It's a talent.
Yeah. Now, luckily, it was mostly the leadership team that was there together, so mm-hmm. we could work through this very quickly. But in a broader meeting, these would be very difficult, right? So what we've actually spent a lot of time, you know, really scaling back our meetings, the size of our meetings, the length of our meetings, to avoid some of this stuff
yeah.
happening in meetings, to make them more efficient.
Yep.
Because what was happening is you basically were having hour-long meetings with like half of the company and you weren't getting mm-hmm. anywhere. And so we started cutting those out and really just started shrinking these things down into a series of meetings where with certain teams we meet weekly mm-hmm. because we need to know what's going on a weekly cadence. With other teams, we move those to monthly. We bring them all together on a monthly basis to kind of educate them and enable them on what they need to know once a month instead of on a weekly basis to give them their time back. Like, you also have to understand how to manage your different meeting structures and keep them very efficient.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, I think it's also refactoring based upon the change in work, right? We used to do a lot of remote work. We're doing a lot of remote work since COVID, right? And so I think in changing that, we're trying to use the same method of management style that we used to use when everybody was in the office. And so right. it's easy to get everybody in a room. And I think now people feel like, man, why are we all sitting here on a Zoom call, right? Like, we could knock this out in 20 minutes and move on and actually get some stuff done. And so I think it's the efficiency that we need to build back in. And I think taking these things and, you know, it's not just for us. You have to take this type of information and cascade it down to your leaders, right? So they can start to think about this. And sometimes it's not calling them out in the meeting. Sometimes it's having that, you know, 5 minute aside and being, mm-hmm. hey, man, we just got bogged down in this gravity issue. How would you handle that differently moving forward, right? And it's that coaching.
Yeah, I think remote work magnified it because decisions by committee have never been efficient. Trying to get 20 people in a meeting, whether it's in person or on a Zoom, and try to make a decision there, it's notorious for going off the rails. So that's why, you know, to Matt's point, refine the message. Get a core set of folks where you can sit back and say, all right, what's the problem? What are the options? And then, because you want people, you want the team's involvement. You want them to have a say. You want to be able to listen to them. But you also want to be able to refine it down to a point where it's not going to be this monolithic task to make a decision.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing, yeah, and I mean, the benefit was, and the reason we did this meeting, we did it in person for that exact reason, because we knew we were going to end up here. Right. And so in order to minimize all these distractions, we all locked ourselves in a room for an hour and a half and worked through it. It's harder to do that remote, right? These distractions we probably would not have gotten to the same point in that same hour and a half if we weren't all in the same room working together. It was kind of a forcing function for us to get through all these distractions. Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me today. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening. We'll see you next week on Business Security Week.